Well, welcome to this edition of the Royal Vet College podcast, Veterinary Science on the Move. My name's Mark Cleesby, and today I'm privileged to have as a guest Professor Jo Price, who's going to talk to us about her interests in deer antler biology and tissue regeneration. So, Jo, I guess we're all used to seeing stags wandering around either in parks or out in the wild with fine sets of headgear on their heads, but what exactly is an antler?
Well, an antler, contrary to popular opinion, is not made of skin. It's not like an antelope horn. It's a bone. It's a bone rather like the bone of your leg, which grows by a similar process. So in the winter, when they're used for fighting, they are solid dead bones attached to a permanent extension on the animal's skull called a pedicle. So they're bone, but they're in the spring when they're growing, they're covered in skin, which people normally know as velvet, and then they're active growing bones made of cartilage and at the growing tip and bone nearer the base.
So they're very different from horns then that you get in a lot of other species.
Yeah, absolutely. They're not specialised keratin. They're actually bone, slightly bendier bone than bone of the femur, for example. It's got a slightly different material properties. Mm-hmm. But obviously that relates to the fact that it needs to be a little less stiff for when they're fighting, otherwise they would be more brittle and break too much.
Yes, and probably quite a few people are aware that stags, in fact, lose their antlers in an annual fashion. So, I mean, what exactly are they used for by the stags? And you know, what's really the evolutionary reason why they come and go on this seasonal basis? It seems like quite a heavy investment in terms of resources to do that.
Yes, I mean, it's a lot of resource that the animal has to take from its body to grow the antler during the spring and summer. But the advantage of it is that it means that they get bigger antlers every year. So it gives them an advantage, because basically the bigger your antlers, the better your pulling power is as far as attracting females. So the first set of antlers that I will stead are spiked. They're very simple antlers. They fall off, they grow back with a small set in their second year of life, but then every year they get progressively larger, so that as the stag becomes sexually more successful, his antlers get bigger.
So, I mean, are they used directly for fighting, though, presumably, so and competition between the different stags, I guess?
That's right, they're display. You know, they're often just using them to warn each other off, and then they use them directly for fighting. Even though they don't often directly injure each other, they're there to push each other about, basically.
So does that mean that the larger set of antlers, the older stag, is inevitably going to have more reproductive success, is going to be more virile, or is that just a simplification?
No, it's not, actually, and there is some evidence now from work of people like Eduardo Roldan in the department that antler size is related to sexual success, so that the quality of sperm can be related to antler size.
And it relates presumably directly to the number of hinds that stag will have in its group.
So that there is a clear connection now between the secondary sexual characteristics and a selection advantage.
Okay, so I mean, how is it that it's possible for this tissue to grow so rapidly and you know, basically be able to be replaced every year?
Well, if we knew why it could grow so fast, we'd probably be richer than we are, because that's been the holy grail of antler biologists, is to understand this phenomenal rate of growth at a molecular level. It would appear that antler growth uses similar mechanisms that are involved in bone growth or bone development. So there are the same pathways are involved, except everything is exaggerated. People have spent time looking for magic antler factors. So when I was doing my PhD 30 years ago, a company was set up to look specifically for what might be in antlers, a bone anabolic agent that was in antlers. But the more people look, the more they're coming up with known candidates, and now people are using proteomic sort of approaches to look for candidates that are in antler. The critical thing is how the local factors relate to the endocrine factors. So we know, for example, that insulin-like growth factor 1 levels correlate with antler growth. So we know the levels are high in the serum, and we know that if you add IGF-1 to antler cells, they'll proliferate. So there are certain candidates we know probably are important players, but how all of them come together and orchestrate to produce this phenomenal rate of growth is really not that well understood. I mean, they're phenomenally vascularized, for one thing. You've got a large stem cell population there, which are programmed to divide quickly. And the other thing, which is what we have some evidence for, is that the antlers grow when the stags have low concentrations of sex hormones. And it would appear that low concentrations of sex hormones are what's needed for rapid growth. And if you think about it, there are parallels with human puberty, because at stages of quite rapid pubertal growth, it's primed by sex hormones, but then you have a sex hormone independent phase of that as well. So it would appear that it's linked quite closely to the levels of sex hormones, and because the antler cycle is linked to sex hormones, you can develop a system whereby when sex hormone levels are low, the antlers will fall off and they'll grow very, very quickly. As the sex hormone levels go up at the end of the antler cycle, then you get a suppressive effect on growth, rather like what happens at the end of puberty in women and men. As sex hormone levels peak, then you get this suppression of growth. So it's a finely tuned system, triggered at the beginning and the end by sex hormones, but then there's obviously a milieu of signalling molecules in the middle which all work together to make it go really fast.
So are there other hormones that have been identified to be involved, or it's a bit of a black box there at the moment?
Lots of them have been measured in the serum of deer. That's what people used to do years ago when there were no tools available to look at the molecular mechanisms. And yes, people have found a relationship between vitamin D levels and antler growth, but they're all associations rather than direct correlations, if you like.
Okay, so I mean, how does the sort of growth process then triggered in this seasonal hormone-dependent fashion? Now, how is that different from sort of bone repair mechanisms, on the basis that these are sort of fairly similar tissues, and obviously growth is involved in both?
I think some of the processes involved in the actual formation of endochondral bone, such as the cartilage that forms during fracture repair, and what happens during antler growth, are probably very similar. What, of course, you don't get with fracture repair is a perfect replica of the structure. If you remove the end of a bone, you're not going to, you know, say the end of our leg, you're not going to ever be able to get the patterning effects that you get with antlers. So the difference is that you can get limited repair with a bone. The periosteum can give you repair, or provide you with the cells for repair, but if you get enough bone being lost, say from a fracture, you're never going to go back to having a functional whole. So the thing about the antler is that it's got a pre-programmed pattern, if you like, which is recapitulated every year.
Right.
So I think the mechanisms that underlie the two are not totally dissimilar. That's why we tend to study antlers, because we think it's got quite important parallels for fracture repair.
Okay.
In that way.
And you end up with two mirror image antlers, or?
They're very similar to each other. Yeah, they are practically mirror images of each other.
Okay.
And the shape is not dissimilar every year, even though they get bigger. The shape is recognisable every year. So if you go to the Natural History Museum, there's a set of antlers from one stag, and those antlers are very similar. They just got bigger with a few more points on them.
Okay, so what happens then after the rut, I guess, when the shedding occurs? What's the process going on there?
Well, as far as we know, it's mediated by osteoclasts, which is cells that resorb bone. And what will trigger shedding is a change in day length. So as the day length increases, this is in red deer, the model that we use. So as the day length gets longer, say towards the end of April, early May, shedding happens around that time, and the mechanism involved appears to be a fall in sex hormone. So clearly day length is affecting the hypothalamic pituitary axis, which then affects sex hormone levels. You can mimic shedding by castrating the deer. So if you castrate a deer in the middle of winter, it will shed its antlers probably 2 weeks later.
Mm-hmm.
So there is an association between the low sex hormones and osteoclasts. So that's not dissimilar to what happens in postmenopausal osteoporosis. So low sex hormones means more osteoclast activity, except in the case of the deer, you've got a very high activity of these cells in one particular bit, which is when they shear off the antler where it's attached to the pedicle bone.
Right, so the osteoclasts are basically chewing away at the base of the antler until it falls off then?
No, it's not like that, because they don't wobble off. They are actually tightly attached to the skull 1 minute, and then probably within half an hour they fall off. So it's clearly a situation where you've got osteoclasts differentiating. That means they're forming at that site, and then something hormonal activates them. They must be poised, ready to go, because it's not like a sort of loosening of a tooth, which will happen over a couple of days. It's a very, very dramatic process, and then the next antler will fall off usually within a couple of days, and it can fall off within hours, but one often falls off the day before the other.
Okay, so that's obviously, it's very tightly regulated.
It's quite tightly regulated, and it would be nice to know what did that. There is a general systemic osteoporosis going on at the same time, because if you measure resorption products in the blood around that time, there's massive turnover of bone, and that almost certainly is that the other sites in the skeleton are getting increased resorption, but that's to provide you with enough mineral to grow the antlers when they're growing. So if you measure things like collagen degradation products, they really peak around the time of shedding. In fact, they peak a little bit before the time of shedding, as if the hormonal changes are actually causing bone loss at other places as well.
Okay, and then the next year, obviously, they get a new set of antlers. So this is, I guess it's analogous to a sort of regeneration process that one sees in a lot of the lower vertebrates, amphibians, for example. But what's actually going on the cellular level? I mean, what's the sort of cell type that's going to be involved in this sort of regenerative process when the new antler's coming along? Is it sort of de-differentiation of mature cells, or are we getting a particular variety of stem cell which is being activated?
Most evidence suggests that it's a stem cell mediated process from cells which live in specialised periosteum, which lies over the pedicle bone. The problem is it's very difficult to do the right kind of experiments to prove that is definitively the case. So in newts, for example, we know that de-differentiation of myotubes is an important process in the regenerative capability. It looks in the antler histologically as if you've got expansion of a population of cells which are likely to be stem cells in the periosteum, from what we can tell. And people have labelled the cells crudely, and you can seem to track some of them into the new antler. The difficulty is, as I say, doing elegant, definitive lineage tracing studies whereby you get a dye or something into those cells and then see exactly where they go. And first of all, when you've got the dye in, what exactly are those cells? So it's still indirect evidence, but it's assumed now generally that it probably is more like a fracture repair situation where you've got stem cells in a periosteum, because the periosteum is now known increasingly to have multipotent stem cells in it.
Right, okay.
So that's what we think is going on. We think that those cells that are stem cells in the periosteum are persistent cells that are neural crest derived, because the antler grows on the frontal bone. Frontal bones derive from neural crest. We know that the fetal antler is neural crest derived, and you can find cells with these neural crest like markers in the periosteum, and there are more of them during the regenerative phase and in the non-regenerative phase, which suggests that they at least contribute to it.
So I mean, does that imply that the processes involved are quite different between say antler growth and a frog that's lost its leg, or a lizard that's lost its tail, or they're both likely to come down to regeneration from stem cells?
Well, no, I think that they are different, and all regenerative models use slightly different variations on a theme. For example, the newt is now known to have some stem cell based regeneration, even though primarily it's dedifferentiation. Xenophus tail regeneration is stem cell based, for example. So you've got a whole different variety of systems used in different regenerative models, if you like. So they diverge, I think, in the level of dedifferentiation and the level of stem cells.
Right.
Or level of stem cells involvement in the process. Where I think there's more conservation is in the pathways that they use to get those cells from their undifferentiated state, whether that's dedifferentiated by origin or from stem cells, then into a fully formed whole. So pathways are shared, so WNT pathways are shared between all of these different organisms.
This common signaling,
molecule. So, but what might be involved in an newt, for example, which is a nerve type derived factor, we now know, well, Jeremy Rocks in UCL has identified a ligand for this molecule PROD1 from regenerating nerves as being critical for regeneration in newts. It's totally nerve dependent. That doesn't seem to be the system that we've got going on in deer. That seems to be sex hormone dependent. So the external trigger, if you like, I think is different. It doesn't mean that nerves aren't important for antler growth, but again, it's really difficult to do the experiment. If you take the nerves away, they don't feel the antlers, so they damage them, and therefore the growth is affected, and it's hard to know whether they are really dependent on that.
Right, I mean, yes, it must be a very complicated system to try and investigate, or for practical reasons, in vivo, certainly.
Exactly, and that's why, I mean, there is an argument for saying, well, you shouldn't use the model because they are so genetically intractable, and it's hard to do those kind of experiments. On the other hand, they are still mammalian, and that sets them apart from the other systems.
Yes, is this the only mammalian instance of what one could term regeneration?
Yeah, true regeneration of repeated sort of reformation, if you like, again and again of a structure which is a fully functional replica of the original is not found in mammals. I mean, liver regenerates obviously very, very well, but it doesn't do it indefinitely.
So I guess that makes it quite a unique model then, in terms of thinking about mammals, or, you know, humans or animals as we do. So, I mean, can you anticipate that sort of increasing our knowledge of the mechanisms involved in regeneration and, you know, antler growth and shedding may be able to benefit human or animal healthcare through, for example, I don't know, repair of organs, if we understand the mechanisms of what's going on in antlers?
I think the beauty of antlers is it would appear to be a stem cell system, which is now becoming a really increased area of activity. If you think about it, adult stem cells and what controls them is really one of the holy grails of modern regenerative medicine. Because
yes,
the critical thing is going to be understand what triggers them from their, if you like, quiescent state into to sort of going back into the cell cycle again and forming a whole antler. And I think if we can actually dissect out the link between the environmental triggers, if you like, and the local cellular mechanisms, then that will give us clues as to how we can better affect repair in humans or in animals. And I think there are a number of applied benefits, really, for if you could understand what makes antlers shed, or in the processes involved, about how you get site specificity in terms of bone resorption. It would tell us something quite important about why, for example, in osteoporosis you get particular parts of the skeleton that lose bone more than others. So there are a number of kind of spin-offs, if you like. And we've talked mostly about bone, but of course antlers are covered in skin, and the velvet skin of an antler is growing at a phenomenal rate, and it also is scarless, so if it gets injured the skin doesn't scar. So dissecting out why that is the case could have quite important implications for human wound repair. Also, nerves in antlers grow faster than in any other mammalian structure, and so that again is a very good way of looking at what are the signals that might be involved in nerve regeneration. And while you might not be able to do all the experiments in a deer because of the fact that you haven't got, you know, transgenic deer, and they're not easily manipulatable, you can get some clues in the deer, and then you can go away and test out your hypotheses in mice or in other models.
Okay, well, I mean, that all sounds fascinating in terms of the potential benefits of looking at antler regeneration and potentials for human and animal health in the future. So, Joe Price, thank you very much for that insight.
Pleasure.
Well, thank you for listening to this edition of the RBC podcast. If you have any feedback or suggestions for us, you can email us at podcast@rbc.ac.uk. See you next time.